That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison. And we're excited to welcome to the podcast today Jonathan Hunt, who is an assistant professor at the Air War College, and he's also the author of The Nuclear Club, How America and the World Policed the Atom from Hiroshima to Vietnam. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's really exciting to speak to you, to your audience as well. Wanted to lead off as well. I'm contractually obliged to state that the views that I share today do not reflect those of the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. So with that out of the way, I'm happy to talk about the subjects and themes of my book and also nuclear weapons and U.S. grand strategy more generally.
No, that sounds good. And this actually gives me an opportunity to say everything that we say on American Prestige is representative of what the DOD thinks. So
absolutely. I have an earpiece right now. They're feeding stuff to me as we do this.
Jonathan, your book is titled The Nuclear Club. So why don't we actually just start with what does that term mean and why is it an important thing to analyze its development?
So I think it's a term and, it's always, I think, a fun way to describe kind of how a book matures by, when you actually come up with the final title. And I will totally admit it took me probably until the page proofs phase to really kind of wrap my mind around, the Nuclear Club as a title. And I think it's one with which, most people, even those who follow kind of the news, somewhat infrequently are familiar, this kind of idea that there's a select group of nations out there in the world that for whatever reason are kind of sanctified as being special, as being able to possess nuclear weapons to benefit from, the various characteristics that they have, the various responses and perceptions that they sort of evoke in their audiences. And then there's kind of the rest of the world, the other 190, odd nation states recognized by the United Nations that for whatever reason, and this is kind of what the book tries to explain, have been kind of multilaterally disarmed, that have been, prescribed from joining this otherwise select, kind of the most exclusive club on earth, as I put it at one point in the book.
So why don't we actually just start at the beginning, which is the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So what was the initial response to these bombings? What were some of the plans that were going around in the immediate aftermath of the advent of at least the advent of an atomic weapon use at the time?
Yeah, so this is, it's a deep history. It's a history that has kind of been written somewhat exclusively and, almost generated, I think, kind of a cultural fascination with the Manhattan Project, with the story of these, geniuses sitting on a kind of mountain plateau out there in New Mexico, devising this, kind of almost cosmic power and harnessing it for the purposes of the U.S. national security state, maybe the purposes of humanity as well, as a reason that we have this, forthcoming biopic about J. Robert Oppenheimer coming out soon. It's one that people not only have been interested in as in history classes or in the broader culture, but also people might actually want to go pay $15 or whatever it costs these days to sit through a, 2.5-hour mind-bending experience about the invention of nuclear weapons. So the way the story has been told, I think, for decades now is really fixated on these atomic scientists. In part, this was because the atomic scientists were quite prolific after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think Cold War culture sort of placed upon their shoulders this kind of mantle of like a special wisdom that went along with their scientific and technological genius, that they had this right and responsibility to kind of speak to these cosmic forces they unleashed, right? The classic Oppenheimer quote of, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds." my book kind of tries to internationalize this story a little bit and actually bring to the table some of the humanitarian responses to the atomic bombings. So the first chapter actually begins with the story of two International Committee of the Red Cross observers who had been in Japan and in the Asian theater of the Second World War for a few years, kind of looking into Japanese practices, prisoners of war, things like that. And in the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Emperor Hirohito actually appealed to the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva, Switzerland, to look into the bombings as, what they weren't terms at the time. So these are kind of anachronisms, crimes against humanity, more specifically that they contravened in some ways the Geneva Conventions. And so, the first responder was Fritz Bilfinger. There were others who kind of came after him who wrote about their experiences as really the first Westerners to visit Hiroshima and then Nagasaki, or at least those who hadn't been in the city at the time. And so I think this kind of narrative of whether or not nuclear weapons, at least from the International Committee of the Red Cross, considered to be the custodians of international humanitarian law, the laws of war, whether or not they kind of in and of themselves, if they were evil in and of themselves, that they were comparable to, say, chemical weapons, that their use should be banned, or even more radically, that their mere possession should be considered a violation of the laws of war or kind of customary international law. So this humanitarian narrative, I think it's better known among international lawyers, certainly the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Red Cross affiliates. And it also was the major inspiration behind the Bann Treaty that was negotiated over the past 10, 15 years or so, and has attracted a number of signatories from various countries around the world. I don't know what it is, a last count, if it's at least 40 or 50, if not 70 or 80. And many international observers see it as in competition with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which has been the cornerstone of global nuclear order and the global nonproliferation regime. And it kind of harkens back to this immediate response, this sense among these humanitarian observers that nuclear weapons, the devastation that they wrought, the havoc that they caused, especially for medical first responders, and then the grievous and insidious and long-term harms that they visited upon the bombed, were simply incompatible with humanitarian notions of warfare. So my book kind of draws upon this, and also the connections to discourse in the United States, John Hershey's famous reporting for The New Yorker, which is eventually put together in a compendium, Hiroshima. It's a huge bestseller at the time. He actually donates his proceeds from the New Yorker articles to the American Red Cross. And so he himself, as the author, kind of sees this connection. But it's even a sentiment shared by President Harry S. Truman, who, there's great recent work by Alex Wellerstein to show that Truman doesn't fully understand. He's kind of been advised, but either mishears or is somewhat misadvised that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are purely military targets. And so he feels some level of remorse about the number of especially women, pregnant women, children, old men who died in the bombings. And there's some evidence even that he was unaware that the strike against Nagasaki had been was moving forward, that he had kind of almost set it on a kind of like automaticity within the U.S. Army, the U.S. Army Air Corps, to basically drop these bombs as soon as they became available. And so in the wake of the Nagasaki bombing, he reasserts a kind of presidential control over the use of nuclear weapons. When he does so, he invokes these humanitarian principles. And that would really kind of form the basis of this presidential authority over the use of nuclear weapons, over the nuclear enterprise more generally. And as my book tries to show, eventually gets kind of woven into the global nuclear nonproliferation regime in ways that create, I would say, an incentive, or at least a political language, for U.S. Commanders in chief to justify military intervention in the name of global nuclear peace.
So famously, the atomic bombs follow the firebombing of Tokyo, an enormous amount of damage done by Curtis LeMay and others in the AAF, Army Air Forces. So why was this weapon considered different? Because some people at the time are saying it's actually not different. It's just kind of an intensification, a qualitative intensification, but, you know, fundamentally the same. What were debates around sort of the nature of the bomb?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, and I would actually include the humanitarians, the International Committee on the Red Cross, although there's a lot of internal debate within their ranks as to whether the atom bomb, nuclear weapons more generally, but also ballistic missiles, chemical weapons, biological forms of warfare, whether they should all be kind of lumped in the same category as industrialized warfare as forms of total war, or if there was something about nuclear weapons that was somewhat unique. I think for most international humanitarians, if I can kind of group them together as a class, there was a sense that the atom bomb was just kind of the punctuation point on this gradual and then accelerating dehumanization of modern warfare. Not only the means of warfare, but the ways in which states were being mobilized fully in pursuit of national interests. And so I think there was this concern to the extent that the atom bomb was seen as somewhat unique, sui generis, by humanitarians. It was this kind of like point of no return, that if this was not where we drew the line to label, to designate, one of these weapon systems as evil in and of itself, that not just its use, but even its mere possession was against any humane ideal of warfare, that there was really kind of no further one could sink. And so there were voices within the International Committee of the Red Cross. They were eventually, kind of outmaneuvered and overruled between 1945 and 1949, because there's a lot of conversation about further evolving the Geneva Conventions to cover aerial bombardment. You know, of course, this is, you can, Guernica kind of is one of the first pieces of evidence that the Geneva Conventions are really not going to do much about terror bombing. And there's real efforts to kind of expand the laws of war to include aerial bombardment. And eventually it really runs headlong into this problem of, well, the United States in particular is heavily invested in its just growing air force, but also strategic bombing, inclusive of atomic bombing. And so ultimately, those voices within the International Committee of the Red Cross are outmaneuvered both in Geneva and also by the American Red Cross and the U.S. government. And they more or less, head off this effort to expand the laws of war to include aerial bombardment as well as the atom bomb.
So Truman reasserts presidential authority, and then what are the international discussions about reigning in the atomic bomb? How do U.S. policymakers respond? And maybe you could just take us through that first decade, 45 to 55, when the nuclear club doesn't really exist yet.
Yeah, there's an era of what historians call the U.S. nuclear monopoly, which pretty much persists from 1945 to 1950. There's a whole kind of side story there about essentially underestimating the Soviets, underestimating the quality of their nuclear scientists, of their engineers as well, the industrial capacity of the Soviet Union after it had been, absolutely shell-shocked by the Second World War. And generally, especially by individuals like Brigadier General Leslie Grove, he's sort of the military counterpart to Oppenheimer, who just think the Soviets don't have like the inherent, and there's a certain racialism to it as well, the inherent capability to kind of grasp these cosmic mysteries. So the era of the U.S. strategic nuclear monopoly doesn't last nearly as long as people believe it will, especially within the U.S. government. The nuclear scientists, by contrast, those who worked in and around the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer and his ilk, Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, those who had remained outside the Manhattan Project, they were much better apprised of the relative capacity of Soviet scientists. And so they were often kind of alone in the wilderness, ringing these alarm bells and basically making the case for international control of atomic energy. Their time horizon for the American nuclear monopoly, it's just far shorter. And eventually, they come up, and especially Oppenheimer, with what's called the Acheson-Lilienthal plan that evolves in time to the Baruch plan. It basically would create an international organization under the United Nations Atomic Energy Agency, that would control all fissile materials around the world. So primarily uranium and thorium mining. This would permit the United Nations to just essentially cut off the supply for any other countries that desired their own nuclear arsenals. It would require as well a certain amount of collaboration and coordination within what is a new-fledged United Nations, one that includes a UN Security Council with permanent members wielding vetoes. And so, infamously, the Baruch plan kind of comes apart because the Acheson-Lilienthal plan, Truman appoints Bernard Baruch, who's like a New York financier and a Democratic Party fixer, to come in and kind of lead this kind of the U.S. presentation and its campaign in the UN Atomic Energy Committee. And he adds this kind of poison pill, which is that as this plan is being implemented, as atomic energy and uranium and thorium are being placed on international control, these permanent member vetoes that are wielded by the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the Republic of China, which will soon disembark the mainland for Taiwan, and the Soviet Union, their vetoes would not be operational while the plan was being was underway. And so the Soviets, of course, see this as a non-starter. Their nuclear weapon program, was already somewhat fledgling even before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Hiroshima and Nagasaki pretty much set it into overdrive. Of course, Klaus Fuchs and other atomic spies are secreting out the blueprints for the Trinity device. And so in order for the Soviets to agree to the Baruch plan, they basically have to agree to being immediately under sanction, if not the threat of military intervention, because they would contravene the plan almost from the word go.
Jonathan, I'm curious, and first of all, I think it's fantastic that we were doing race essentialism with the Soviets, which is not a nationality. They didn't exist 20 years earlier.
It's all over the place, Derek, in the late 40s.
We're doing analysis of the Soviet mind. It's fascinating. Just fascinating. They're incapable of understanding.
And a multi-ethnic empire, right? So they just don't fit.
What are you doing, guys?
Yeah.
Was there any carrot to this, or was it just supposed to be, we're going to go to the UN and fix the system so that we can Bigfoot everybody and force this clampdown where the United States would be the only nuclear power and the rest of the world will just have to kind of shrug its shoulders and say, oh, well, I guess that's closed off to us? Or was there anything that was supposed to be a reward for accepting this U.S. status?
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say, the Acheson-Lilienthal plan, as it starts, and really, this is the creation of Oppenheimer. He's really the brains, and he's also influenced by the thinking of Niels Bohr, who's a Danish, Nobel Prize laureate. The carrots there are that the United States will unilaterally disarm, in essence. It'll disarm its nuclear capability within the context and the confines of this new kind of international agency, but it will nonetheless give up its nuclear arsenal. And the Baruch plan, again, despite this poison pill, would also envisage, a relatively expeditious disarmament of the U.S. nuclear arsenal as well. So there was that was the carrot, a world in which you would have a higher degree of international control over really the apex military technology. It's something that was not unprecedented. And so the Soviets, their response to it is basically, hey, let's do the same thing we did with chemical weapons, with nuclear weapons. And so this is known as the Gromyko plan, after the Soviet foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko, who would be there for a long time. He'd remain foreign minister for 30 plus years. I think he actually was in a deputy position at the time beneath Molotov, but he would stay really at the apex of Soviet foreign policy for decades and decades, even into the Gorbachev era. And so he basically says, hey, let's do what we did with chemical weapons after the First World War and just have kind of a moratorium on the use of nuclear weapons. And, you know, there's some nuances here. So technically, the United States would be able to maintain its nuclear arsenal. There were some kind of different versions of this plan. So the kind of pure analogy to the chemical weapons ban would be you could have them, but you couldn't use them, which would keep in place, you know, uses like nuclear deterrence, which is how nuclear weapons tend to be used anyway. Gromyko goes further and says not just the use, but the possession of these weapons of mass destruction. It's not a term that's used at the time, but nuclear weapons should be outlawed as well. Again, just sign a treaty, do away with them. We don't need any of this kind of fancy international mechanism or organization or authority. This is just kind of state-to-state negotiation. You pledge to disarm and we pledge not to acquire nuclear weapons. And they negotiate about this, you know, over these two plans for about 18 months. Doesn't really go anywhere. And of course, again, this is against the backdrop of increasing Cold War tensions, what would become, you know, the Cold War between the two superpowers. So it's kind of part of that story, but it's also somewhat the victim of various disagreements over the status of Eastern Europe, over Iran, over access to the Mediterranean for the Soviets, and then, of course, eventually Korea, which really just blows everything up.
Is there any thought given to a concept that comes up again and again, you know, in more recent times, the concept of the nuclear weapons threshold state? Under the U.S. proposal, the Baruch plan, the U.S. gives up its nuclear arms, but it remains the only demonstrated nuclear weapons capable state. And you can't do anything about that once you've kind of, you know, broken that threshold. Is there any thought given to, like, you know, are the Soviets going to be able to research this stuff? Or these, are other countries going to be able to research to get themselves to the point where all you need is some fissile material and a warhead and you can, you know, you're a nuclear weapon state overnight? Or is it just about the access to the materials themselves?
So I think, you know, many historians and also arms control experts and physicists, chemists, kind of look back at the Acheson-Lilienthal plan and the assumptions that Oppenheimer made and consider them to be somewhat naive, or at the very least, that they were eventually invalidated by additional information. And the biggest assumption that Oppenheimer made was that uranium and thorium was really rare, which during the Second World War, and, you know, everybody's way too busy, you know, sending tanks and airplanes and mass formations across borders to, you know, really apply a lot of their state capacity to finding more uranium and thorium. You know, they're pretty much just relying on the stuff that, you know, really the nuclear physicists and, you know, like Marie Curie were using to make these kind of fundamental discoveries, stuff out of the Congo, out of Czechoslovakia, Canada. There's a few other, you know, kind of known uranium and thorium deposits. Very soon, once people realize how precious this stuff is from, you know, not only from a national security perspective, but also energy production, they start finding it everywhere. And so the idea that an international agency or authority could have this monopoly over uranium and thorium resources worldwide, I mean, even it really would have taken a form of world government that probably wasn't in the offing in 1945.
Yeah, as are the names of the books, One World or None, you know, like these are the books that are literally talking about you need world government, basically.
Yeah, and it's not just the atomic scientists, right? It's like, if you go back and read a lot of the kind of the original classical realist of, you know, the Hans Morgenthaus and the George Kennans, you know, generally they're very skeptical of international organizations, let alone world government. But there's something about the nuclear question, about this kind of prospect. Herman Kahn called it, actually, you know, somewhat derisively, this nuclear ultimacy, that nuclear weapons pose this existential threat, not only to humanity and civilization, but even to like planetary life, that it led even committed, you know, realists and conservatives to say, well, maybe we need world government. Maybe you could draw some analogies to, you know, the climate crisis today, but it really screwed with people's sense of the possible and the necessary in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and led, you know, even very skeptical thinkers to at least envisage a world of greater international cooperation and even, you know, governance, if not government.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
So the Soviets get their weapon in the, or they get it late summer, and the Americans find out about it in September 49, I believe. And then the Chinese Communist Party seizes power, I believe, officially on October 1st, 49. So this is a big blow to Americans' conception of themselves, their role in history, and everything about that. So how does this change how people approach the nuclear question? Because in my reading of it, I think this is actually when the Cold War truly begins. I know most people have argued that it's 47, somewhere around the Truman Doctrine speech in March, but I really don't think that other possibilities are closed off until the autumn of 49, when then this sort of existential logic takes hold throughout the U.S. security state. And I do view the United States as the prime mover behind the Cold War, not the only mover, but the prime mover. But how does this autumn 49 shift reshape how people are thinking about the nuclear question?
Yeah, so this is, it's a great question. And it's one, I think you're right to say it's hard to disaggregate, as I noted previously, this from other sources of tension in the Cold War. I agree with you that the 49 to 50 period, not only the Soviet tests, the American decision, I'll go into this more in a moment, to proceed with thermonuclear research into thermonuclear warheads, and then eventually NSC 68 and the Korean War, this kind of 1-2-3-4 punch to me really explains the kind of the global, you know, the period where the Cold War really goes global. Whereas previously, I think it was, you know, for the most part, and we should include Mao Zedong's victory in the Chinese Civil War as well, having left that out. We can quibble elsewhere about the extent to which the U.S. Versus the Soviet Union versus the People's Republic of China were prime movers. But I think the nuclear issue is one that serves as an accelerant. It's an accelerant in a couple of different ways. The first, as you note, is the United States and the U.S. national security state kind of goes from a period of, all right, we may not have conventional military superiority in Europe, but we have the bomb. And psychologically, if not necessarily materially, I think for U.S. policymakers and for the military establishment, there's a sense that this kind of ace in the hole would allow them to triumph, to prevail in any real kind of international crisis, and that's gone. In addition, it calls into question not only U.S. military superiority but also technological superiority. The Soviet Union and you know, even kind of going back to Russia, is seen as this despotic backward place. I mean, you just have to read Kennan's, you know, long telegram to see this kind of general notion that Russia and the Soviet Union just lacked this culture of innovation, of scientific discovery, and what's more, that the Iron Curtain would really cut them off from international scientific and technological advances. So that also kind of goes up in flames, or I suppose a radioactive cascade. And then it raises the question of, okay, well, if the Soviet Union can do it, who else can do it? U.S. intelligence, I mean, the British were pretty heavily involved, as were the Canadians in the Manhattan Project. And so, you know, there's a sense probably even before that, that the British Empire is going to be interested in developing its own nuclear weapons. And I think they test their first experimental nuclear device in Australia in 1952. So they're kind of hot on the heels of the Soviet Union. The French have had a world-class nuclear, you know, going back to Marie Curie and her son-in-law, Jules Joliot Curie, who was a socialist, you know, concerns that, you know, the French would not only be more than capable of developing this, but the kind of orientation of the French government is also somewhat questionable in Cold War terms. And so, you know, this kind of combination of, I guess, gut checks, along with the communist victory in the Chinese Civil War and eventually Kim Il-sung's, you know, advance invasion of, you know, what would become South Korea, it really kind of sets the U.S. national security conversation on a very different, more militaristic course. I think that's fairly consensual among historians.
So what is that course? What happens over the early 50s? Korea, you know, all those good things.
Yeah, and so the piece of the story that I think connects to, let's say, nuclear competition is the decision by the Truman administration to move forward with research into thermonuclear weapons. And, you know, one thing that nuclear historians, sort of those who work in the nuclear space, like to remind, you know, our audiences is nuclear weapons, kind of the let's say, the difference in the destructive power of what's colloquially called a hydrogen bomb or, you know, thermonuclear weapons. So essentially weapons that harness not only fission, but also nuclear fusion. So this is the stuff that the stars are made of. The difference in the destructive capability or potential of thermonuclear weapons is to the atom bomb as the atom bomb was to the largest conventional weapon in the Second World War, right? It's an order of magnitude more powerful. So whereas Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, little boy and fat man, we're talking about, you know, I think 12 to 15 kilotons of destructive force. I mean, enough to, you know, more or less devastate the inner core of a city. Thermonuclear weapons are technically unbounded in terms of their destructive power. I mean, theoretically, if you put enough heavy hydrogen or other kind of material that can be fused and kind of constructed the right way, the Soviets at one point construct a 100 megaton thermonuclear device, which they called Tsar Bomba, so the king of all bombs. And it's so destructive that the scientists cap it at about half of its potential, and it's still 57 megatons. So we're talking about a fireball that's, you know, miles in diameter. It's almost hard to comprehend. And even visualizing it was difficult because you would have to be over 100 miles away to be kind of like safely positioned to be able to observe the thing. So this decision by the Truman administration to move forward with thermonuclear research in defiance of the opinion of the General Advisory Committee on which J. Robert Oppenheimer served as chairman, which basically makes the case not for disarmament, but hey, like these atom bombs work. We can just make a lot of those. They're more than powerful enough rather than a bomb that the minority report of the General Advisory Committee describes as a weapon of, well, I mean, essentially as a crime against humanity just in its existence. I'd have to go back and look at the exact phraseology, but it's making the same argument that the International Committee of the Red Cross observers were, which is that thermonuclear weapons were an evil in and of themselves. And that's when you start to see, you know, phrases like nuclear holocaust being associated with it, with all that kind of historical weight behind it.
So I think this naturally brings us to friend of the pod, Dwight D. Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech. So could you maybe talk about what he was going for there? And it might even be worth it to talk a little bit about nuclear propaganda in this moment.
Yeah, so the decision to move forward with the hydrogen bomb in, you know, 49 and 50. And again, this was a decision that, you know, powerful forces within the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, in the White House and the Department of Defense, you know, were all, I think, supportive of, that led in time actually to J. Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance being revoked, in essence, because of this vendetta by powerful kind of pro-nuclear individuals in the Truman administration and eventually the Eisenhower administration. It does create a certain vulnerability for the United States. The first thermonuclear test, I'm trying to remember the exact date. It was either 1952 or 1953, But the one that really garners huge international attention and eventually kind of an international outcry is Castle Bravo. And so this was, I believe, in March of 1954. It was the first true thermonuclear weapon exploded by the United States. Previous thermonuclear detonations had been of kind of these boosted, in essence, like fission weapons, like those used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but with kind of additional material that would fuse, that surrounded them, that would boost the power of this internal fission bomb. Castle Bravo, it proves much more powerful than the scientists had predicted, something around the scale of 15 megatons of explosive force. It more or less obliterates the atoll on which it had been situated. The Marshall Islanders, so, you know, also keeping in mind this is a trustee territory, a UN trustee territory of the United States, out in the middle of the Pacific, they're exposed to dangerous levels of radiation, to local and as well as regional fallout. A Japanese fishing vessel not far away, the somewhat ironically named Fortunate or Lucky Dragon, is also irradiated. It returns to port in Japan. One of the sailors succumbs to radiation poisoning. Its entire catch of tuna is basically confiscated and destroyed. It leads to the tuna catch in Japan for many weeks being destroyed as well. And this kind of general fear within the Japanese population, which, you know, for whom seafood is a huge part of their diet, that the seafood had been exposed to nuclear fallout and was therefore, you know, shouldn't be consumed. So the Eisenhower administration, once, you know, it comes into office, is kind of really faced with this dilemma. On the one hand, Dwight D. Eisenhower is really convinced that nuclear weapons provide this kind of asymmetric advantage in Cold War competition with the Soviet Union. And as part of this New Look strategy that would include an increased nuclear arsenal alongside increased tempo for U.S. covert operations, as well as greater efforts at propaganda, would kind of, you know, call into question sort of America's perceived international leadership, that it, especially if these thermonuclear tests were releasing just volcanic amounts of fallout into the global atmosphere, that, you know, somewhat unsurprisingly, international audiences, especially as encouraged by the Soviet Union, by other communist states as well, would, you know, see the United States as a kind of, you know, more as an international contaminator rather than an international leader. So in order to maybe kind of take the harder edges off of this international perception, the Eisenhower administration, somewhat cynically, but I think there is evidence that there was some sincerity, really reaches into the kind of diplomatic and propaganda portfolio to kind of come up with a counter narrative, like something that could accompany this era of you know, the nuclear arms race, with a more positive vision, not only for U.S. Leadership in the world, but also for atomic energy more generally. And, you know, this is something that's somewhat inherent to atomic energy and nuclear technology. You know, rather famously during the Manhattan Project, Enrico Fermi creates the first nuclear power plant kind of in the basement of the University of Chicago's football stadium in order to produce not only energy, but also plutonium that would eventually form part of the nuclear warhead that destroyed, I want to say, Nagasaki. I always get these confused. Not Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the bombs used against them were actually based on different designs. So one of them was based on enriched uranium, which requires just a huge amount of enrichment, either, you know, through a gaseous form or later on in the 1960s, they developed these high-speed centrifuges to do it somewhat more quickly, cheaply, and less conspicuously. But always the easiest path to a nuclear arsenal has been the plutonium pathway, which in essence, you build a nuclear power plant that uses kind of a low level of enriched uranium, and the natural byproduct after chemical reprocessing is plutonium. And so generally, when people worry about proliferation, they tend to assume that this plutonium pathway is the most advantageous for countries. So the kind of nuclear question has always been Janus based. On the one hand, you have this means of you know, massive, if not planetary destruction. On the other hand, nuclear scientists and boosters who are describing the age of atomic energy as an age in which energy would be too cheap to meter, that all the problems of an industrialized society would more or less be solved through the power of the atom. And so the Eisenhower administration really kind of reaches into this deep well of images and symbolism and you know, kind of boosterism going back to H.G. Wells, that Atoms for Peace, this is kind of, you know, the famous speech that he gives to the UN General Assembly, would provide kind of the route out of, a way to solve this Pandora's box. That instead of serving as a means of war, that the atom could transform societies in ways that would render the Cold War almost obsolete, because you wouldn't be fighting over really kind of the material prerequisites to, kind of a good quality of life. It wouldn't really matter if it's communism or capitalism, because energy would just be so abundant that you would have solved kind of the central dilemma of a industrial society, whether consumer-based or not. So he gives this Atoms for Peace speech, I think in December of 1953, to the United Nations. It's really well-received. It's well-received, you know, even by the Soviets and other communist states in Eastern Europe. It's well-received by the developing world as well, because Eisenhower essentially pledges to kind of seed these research reactors, to encourage and invest in education for nuclear scientists and engineers around the world, but also provide a certain amount of fissile material, which has kind of a twofold effect. On the one hand, it decreases the amount of fissile materials, the enriched uranium, the plutonium, with which the United States could grow its arsenal, but it also simultaneously kind of internationalizes, if not globalizes, nuclear research and eventually energy production technology. Although it goes beyond that. I mean, they're selling a pretty utopian vision. I think the Fallout games get this across pretty well, where like not only cheap energy, but also radioisotopes, medical advances, all these kind of amazing, your friend the atom, right? Who's gonna solve all of your problems through the power of atomic chemistry and physics.
So, Jonathan, I think we're at a point where we could maybe wrap up and pick up from Atoms for Peace and beyond next time. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how Eisenhower's speech was received around the world. There's obviously a number of audiences here. There's a U.S. public that may be a little nervous about nuclear weapons. There's the large number of states that might be interested in nuclear research, but you know, there's concerns about proliferation, so we're trying to say we'll help you with the research and hopefully that'll keep the weapons at bay. There's the European governments who are going to be on the front line, essentially. They're going to be the first to go under this new doctrine that Eisenhower wants to push of basically defending Europe with nuclear weapons versus massive conventional buildup. So there's a lot of audiences here, and I'm curious how they all received this speech and also how the Soviets received it and what the response was.
So the response, I mean, it's interesting because it's taking place against the backdrop of Eisenhower's negotiations to end the Korean War. And, you know, I think we often forget that Eisenhower came into office, not unlike, say, Barack Obama or Richard Nixon, for that matter, promising a plan to end a war in which the United States was then involved. So in this case, the Korean War. And so, you know, in many ways, Eisenhower, he is the peace candidate, yet a peace candidate who, at least within the machinery of the National Security Council, is developing kind of this new way of waging the Cold War and waging it, perhaps, trying to wage it on the cheap, to wage it in a way that he thought was intelligent, that was strategically aligned, but also aligned with what he viewed to be kind of American values. I think Eisenhower had this fear that the United States would, you see this eventually, eventuating in his, kind of famous military industrial complex speech of, you know, his farewell address. But this fear that the Cold War was really going to corrupt essential values in the United States and give rise to a garrison state in which this kind of growing military would encroach upon civil liberties and also traditions of, you know, things like a balanced budget. And so, you know, maybe also lumping modern Keynesianism along with international leftism in ways that have proven fairly, I don't know, they continue to influence U.S. political discourse. So the Adams for Peace speech, it's greeted by the Soviets and I think by many in the international community, you know, a fairly new international community. This was a General Assembly that had yet to be transformed by decolonization. And so it still lacked many sovereign nation states from Africa in particular, but also Asia and Latin America. They saw it as an olive branch. They saw it as a potential foundation for U.S.-Soviet détente, hopefully for a diminution of the U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms race, maybe even nuclear disarmament eventually. But for the Soviets, too, they recognize, and there's this great conversation between Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov and Chip Boland, who's, I forget if he was the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union at the time, but he was involved kind of on the sidelines of the Adams for Peace speech in New York. And Molotov basically says, hey, this is great and all, but aren't you basically laying the groundwork, right? Sort of providing the initial prerequisites for national nuclear weapon programs in any country that accepts this Adams for Peace proposal. And so from very early on, the Soviets kind of recognized the maybe the second and third order effects of Adams for Peace of, you know, in essence, nuclear globalization, kind of state-led loop nuclear development, and, you know, kind of this battle for the hearts and minds of the third world. So not only the United States, but the Soviet Union, Western European, Canadian vendors as well would really seek out, you know, both markets as well as international goodwill by spreading nuclear technology and energy production. And the Soviets, you know, they see this as, okay, another arena in which the superpowers would be competing, but also, you know, one that could have some downsides. What happens if you build nuclear research reactors in India or Israel or Cuba, Japan, like all these regions where territorial disputes, where kind of traditional ill will between countries in the region could give rise to nuclearized kind of regional competitions. And so kind of from the word go, the Adams for Peace raises in the minds of the Soviets and I think other kind of interested and knowledgeable observers in the international scene, as well as the national scene in the United States, okay, so this is a great way of maybe legitimating the U.S. nuclear arsenal, legitimating a new look Cold War posture based upon massive nuclear retaliation. But it also could kind of plant the seeds of real nuclear anarchy that the Eisenhower administration and its successors would eventually reap.
Jonathan Hunt, thank you so much. We look forward to having you back soon to talk more about how the nuclear club developed over the 50s and the 60s. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.